the edge of our hope, at the end of our time. We have chosen not only to believe in ourselves, but in each other. Today we face the monsters that are at our door. Today we are canceling the apocalypse.
Now get the hell out of our galaxy.
The strength of this starship lay in its diversity.
You see, our glorious diversity, that is not a threat to who we are. It makes us who we are.
You don't just let things happen. You make a stand. You say no. You have the guts to do what's right when everyone else just runs away.
But we must fight this darkness that is threatening to engulf us. Each of us must be a ray of hope.
Rebellions are built on hope.
Welcome to the Skiffing and Fanty Show.
Seeking positive disability representation in an abled world.
I'm Sean.
I'm Jen.
And today we're joined by two very special guests. We have Sarah Chorin. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
And we're joined by Elsa Shinnison Henry. Hello.
Hi.
So a little bit about these two. So Sarah is a reviewer extraordinaire at Book Room Blues. She reads more books in a week than you probably own. This is true. She is also the only person to have found conclusive evidence of Atlantis using a potato peeler and a cracked spyglass from Belgium. It's a true story.
I am pretty cool. Yes, I will be in history books.
And Elsa is an assistant editor, or as she describes herself more accurately, as editrix, at Fireside Fiction and a blogger at Feminist Sonar, which is a cool name. And prior to this, she served as the official tea taster for the royal family of Eastern Georgia. And we're told that King Johnson had a strong preference for lightly sugared oolong, specifically grown over Icelandic volcanic vents.
He did, in fact, prefer that, although I have to tell you, it gets a little musty.
Welcome to both of you. Jen, you want to let folks know what we're here to talk about?
So, today we are here to talk about disability representation in science fiction and fantasy, both in writing and in the larger community. And I just wanted to start us off with something that is important to me. I, at the age of 8, was taken very ill, and I went blind in my left eye, which, not a huge deal. For the most part, I am completely, I don't want to say normal, but it has had very little effect on my life in terms of how I interact with the world. It has, however, had a huge impact on how the direction my life has taken because of a couple of things that I was not able to participate in and in the larger reality cannot do because it is illegal because I am technically legally blind. But nobody can tell this just by looking at me. So one of the things I wanted to talk about is the representation of and the idea of visible versus invisible disability in science fiction and fantasy and how that plays out in the conversation.
Oh boy, do I have a lot of opinions on that.
Excellent.
Just sort of some background on me. I was born with congenital rubella syndrome. So I'm half blind and half deaf, and I also have a heart condition. And the half-blind means literally I can't see out of one eye like you, but I'm also completely low vision in the eye that I do see out of. So I have cataracted over right eye. It's sort of a creamy aqua color. I really like it, but it does make me visibly disabled. Although because I don't wear stereotypical sunglasses and I can see, I mean, I'm wearing glasses and I look around and I carry a white cane. While I'm visibly disabled, people don't believe it. I empathize with a lot of people who are invisibly disabled because my disability often gets glossed over by how it's represented.
I consider myself invisibly disabled because you can't see my condition unless I'm wearing a brace or using my cane or something, and I don't always need those things. Sometimes someday in the future, I know there'll be days when I need a wheelchair, days when I don't, but right now I'm doing pretty good. But Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, I was born with it. It was a collagen disorder, and I went undiagnosed with it until I was 32 years old, and you really just can't see it. It's not visible. I can't predict from one day to the next what my physical condition will be. Dislocations are phenomenally painful and it's terrifying. So I have a huge amount of anxiety about being out in public with this condition. or like being bumped or something from someone who doesn't know not to touch me, really, because I might fall apart. The invisible aspect of this condition is incredibly frustrating. I have handicap parking tags, and I can't even tell you in the month and a bit since I've had them how many times people have told me, you can't park there, you're not disabled, you don't deserve that spot. So you don't know. People don't know. I don't have to hit your personal level of physically disabled before I'm physically disabled. There's like this social bar. You can't be disabled unless you look a certain way. And it's just not true.
So I actually went on a rant about this about a week ago, because in New Jersey, when you get a disability parking placard, you also get a person with a disability ID. And I often get asked by people on NJ Transit, which I take to go home from New York City, if I buy a disability seat. Conductors will say, if they don't see my white cane, they'll immediately go, I need to see your person with a disability ID. So I get checked a lot about whether or not my disability actually qualifies me for the few so-called benefits of having a disability. And people have asked me for it when we park in disability spots, too. They're like, where's your ID? I don't see your disability. It's like, trust me, I'm disabled.
Well, and the whole aspect of disabled people have certain benefits over non-disabled people is just ridiculous. It's not a benefit for me not being able to walk through a store the whole way without help. It's not a benefit. Parking in the handicapped parking kind of sucks for me. I don't like being there. I don't like the fact that I'm, 30-something years old and I can't walk well. It sucks. So the things that people consider benefits is just the minimum requirement for us to be able to live a life that is somewhat normal.
The reason why we have the parking placard in my case is because I had cataracts and I had cataract surgery, my eyes don't dilate the way that normal people's do. Or I guess not even normal people, just sighted people. So in the dark, if we're walking through a parking lot and a car starts driving down in the middle of the street, I get completely blinded out because my eyes don't adjust to having headlights in them. So I actually am in danger if I'm walking around in a parking lot and it's dark out. And frankly, when it's light out, I'm in danger because I don't have peripheral vision, guys. Parking permit saves my life.
So how do you see that reflecting in how disabilities are written about in science fiction and fantasy?
Well, for starters, can I just address the daredevil in the room?
Please do.
Because everybody writes blind characters to have this, like, supernatural ability to sense when things are around them. And I'm sorry, but that's not actually true. I don't have hypersonic hearing. Actually, I'm deaf in one ear and I wear a hearing aid. I don't have hypersonic touch. I can't sense that you're right behind me. Although I certainly do pay attention. I'm hypervigilant. So that might sort of counter that when you see me react to you standing right behind me, but it's actually not the daredevil thing. I'm not like Daredevil. I can't tell when someone is sneaking up behind me. Please stop writing about blind people like that.
For me, because the only, aside from mental health issues, a disability that I have is being blind to my one eye. And when it happened, there was, of course, the fear, oh my god, what happens if she goes blind in her other eye as well? So we went through a process of trying to prepare me for that inevitable possibility. And it's still something that is kind of in the back of my mind. What happens to my family if I ever lose vision in my right eye for whatever reason? So throughout the course of my life, I've paid very close attention to this representation of these characters because, you know, there's that hope as somebody who could have this happen to very easily. I want to be Daredevil. That sounds awesome. I would like to be the character in, what was it? It was a blind and mute character in From Dusk Till Dawn 2, who was a sniper, and it was absolutely absurd. And it was recognizably absurd, and yet that's what we get. so often.
I was very angry when I saw Rogue One. Chirrut Imwe in Rogue One is blind. And spoiler alert, he shoots at something and knocks it out of the sky.
Yeah, I noticed that too.
I swore out loud in the theater and had a whole bunch of Star Wars fans shushing me.
Oh, for all of it, I mean, for the most part, it's like, wait a minute. Okay, Force-sensitive definitely is not going to cut it in terms of your miraculous ability to kick everybody's asses. But then you take it to that extra level of him somehow having a prediction software in his brain so that he can hear something. And then still predict where it's going to be. And you're like, that sounds nice. Don't think it's going to happen, though. So that kind of leads me. Clearly, there are issues with... And he's basically almost invisibly disabled. He does carry... I don't think he even carries a cane, does he?
He does. He has his staff, but he doesn't use it like a white cane. And I was really disappointed by that, because there's actual fighting styles, like Eskrima, that use sticks. Could do this. Daredevil could do this. Chirrut Imwe could do this. Neither of them do.
Right.
Well, not in the show. In the comics, Daredevil does actually use his cane for fighting. Supposedly. I can't read comics, so that's a whole other conversation.
And I think the terrible Ben Affleck Daredevil movie, I think he does use his cane as a weapon at one point.
Yes. Well, we don't talk about that.
Fair enough.
Sorry, Sarah, you were going to say something?
Well, yeah, it's just my biggest pet peeve with the representation in science fiction and fantasy is, well, first of all, nobody has a clue what Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is, not even my doctor. So I'm not surprised that I've never found a character with my condition in a book. The issues that I have that are more common is severe chronic pain, and there's a lot of emotional backlash that a person feels when they're diagnosed with a chronic incurable degenerative disease. And it's and when I read books and I'm reading about characters with basically any form of disability or chronic pain or something like that, I very rarely do I find an author who is aware of how a character will emotionally address these issues. Usually they're just disabled and then they're emotionally fine. This sucks, but look at how hardcore I am in all these other ways. But the truth is I spend my entire life is worked around my disease, and it literally affects every last thing I do. And along with that, and is just this huge, overwhelming, emotional, I can't believe this is my life thing. I've had to give up so much stuff. And I'm terrified that my kids will inherit this. And it's just, there's a ton of emotional crap that comes along with anything like this. And I rarely see that addressed in novels. And it really bothers me, because that's something that your characters should feel.
It is, and it's not just, I also have chronic pain issues which are undiagnosed, and that's been an emotional experience of what is it about this that we can't even pinpoint?
Yeah.
Why is there no solution? And I feel like that's something else that also doesn't get addressed much in science fiction, is that there's always an answer, yeah. Always, and frequently yeah. There's a cure.
Yeah, that was one of my questions is, you know, how do authors, actually, I'm going to get into that in a second later, because it seems like, for the most part, disability is used as a characteristic, mm-hmm. as opposed to a part of a character. So it's like hair color or eye color or whatever. That's how they treat being blind or using a wheelchair or even pain. It's just mentioned. Oh, they have chronic pain, and then not dealt with in any way, shape, or form after that. If they even have a character who has chronic pain, which is unlikely in the first case. And then add to that the layer of, if they do have a disability, it's probably not that they currently have it, because it has been fixed in some way, shape, or form. Which leads me to the actual question of, how do you deal with, in a technologically or magically advanced world, and I know also that you've written about this pretty extensively, not quote unquote fixing a character, because it's definitely an issue.
I think in some ways the representation like this has improved. I mean, not really. You're right. Most of the books I read still have a cure and a cure narrative and this whole thing. But there are some authors out there who have made a concentrated effort not to cure their characters. And I really appreciate that. Like Stephanie Salter's series, all of her the disability narrative itself is pretty much a cornerstone of the whole series. And her character's hurt and all these things happen to him, and it's fantastic how she handles it all. She's turned people who I'm so used to seeing as secondary back burner characters into main characters who basically are complete badasses. So I appreciate that. But the thing that I kind of want to scream from the rooftops a lot is you don't have to cure people to they don't exist in your, we don't exist in your stories to be cured. And you have to remain true to reality. There's a lot of us out here who are disabled, and we will be disabled for our whole entire lives. We deserve equal representation in your novels. We deserve to be hardcore too, because we can be. And, you know, my brother is autistic and he's paralyzed, and I have this conversation with him all the time, and he will always boil this whole conversation down with, I really want people to realize that I can be amazing too. That's what he says all the time. And I think that's something that it's scary to write disabled characters if you're not disabled, but for the most part, most of the disabled people that I've met, including myself, have absolutely no problems answering questions as long as you're not being a jerk about it. So I don't know if I answered anything, but there you go.
So, as you mentioned, I've written a lot about sort of the cure narrative, and it's pretty well known that I really hate the cure narrative, because the question that I get asked the most by people is, wouldn't you be happy if you could just see out of both eyes? And the response that I give every time is, it's not like you can just wave a magic wand. So there's a lot of people who say, come up to me about their cyberpunk work, and they're like, well, you know, wouldn't you just wear a bionic eye? And the answer to that is, prosthetics aren't that simple. That's how I always started, is like, look, prosthetics aren't that simple, cures aren't that simple. If you want to cure my blindness and make me see out of both eyes, the first thing that you have to contend with doesn't actually have to do with the biology of the eye. It has to do with the neurological condition of, my brain has rewired itself to see out of one eye. How do you solve that problem first? So the question that I really throw out to science fiction writers is, if you are writing cure narratives, are you addressing the fact that it's actually not that easy? Because frequently the answer is, well, no, I just want to cure it. Okay, you can't just do that. You have to address the psychological experience of what it would be like to actually cure someone of something that they've had their entire lives, potentially.
Right.
And the other thing that I kind of want to butt in and tack on to that is, there's a whole lot of disabled people who wouldn't get rid of their disabilities, too.
I wouldn't.
Yeah, and you know, I hate my condition. I really hate it, but it has impacted every aspect of my life, my entire life, and it has helped me as much as it has hurt me, because I am a way different person with it than I would have been without it. And I'm okay with who I am. And I'm becoming okay with the fact that I will never be cured. But the fact that we need to address the issue that not everyone who is disabled would get rid of their disabilities. The cure narrative is not something a lot of us want, for whatever reason.
You know, for me, it comes down to the fact that, one, I don't want a cure because I don't know how I would adjust after living the life that I've lived for 30-something years.
Yeah.
That sounds like it would take a lot of time out of just what I'm already doing, and I'm leading a pretty great life right now. But also, you know what I would like more than someone putting time into a cure? is I would like it if people found ways to make my life better. So rather than putting time into figuring out how to cure blindness or how to cure deafness, maybe make better hearing aids or have driverless car technology actually in my lifetime. These are things that would make my life better, measurably.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the subject of this, like, one of the questions I actually wanted to ask was about what you guys saw as the biggest no-nos in terms of representing, and we've kind of already kind of covered that to some degree. And when you started talking about the sort of cure narrative, it made me think of one of the other problematic narratives, which is like the inspiration porn narrative.
Oh, God, I hate that.
Oh, good. Okay, so you're going to have opinions. Good. Because I wanted to sort of get your guys' opinions on this about, you know, your perspective on how that is presented and the problems that it presents, you know, in terms of how we've seen it used in fiction. And I guess, Sarah, since you immediately started with you hate it, I'm going to go to you.
I have such a hard time articulating some of this stuff because my thoughts are very strong, so I might circle around myself a little bit. But inspiration porn really pisses me off, and it's mostly because it's like the story in the newspaper that we all see about the boy who took the Down syndrome kid to the prom, and wasn't that whole thing sweet? It addresses the fact that this boy was wonderful. It's all about the able-bodied person who did this wonderful thing. Nobody ever addresses how did the kid with Down syndrome feel? Did she have fun? Did she even want to do that? Did she want to be part of this thing? The narrative with that stuff is so focused, so ableist focused, that the disabled person is basically just like a pinup doll. They're just there so that all the abled people can feel great that this kid did something for someone else. And that just bothers me. That's in its most fundamental way. Inspiration porn to me is just like, I don't know, scratching the ego for some people. It just fundamentally doesn't address the experience of being disabled. The disabled person's just never addressed. And also, along with that, I'm not a saint, and I don't like it when my experiences are boiled down to, wow, isn't that great that you're going through all this stuff and you're still, you know, walking your kid to school or whatever it is. That's so neat. It's not neat. I'm just existing. I'm being me. I'm not doing anything amazing. I'm just living my freaking life. And that shouldn't be something that other people need to be proud of for me. I don't even know if that makes sense. But
oh,
there
it totally
you go.
Does. I'm actually going to use an example from yesterday, because I had a really great day yesterday. And then I posted about it on Twitter, and I had to tack on a please don't make this inspiration porn addendum. Because I realized that people would try to twist it, and I didn't want that to happen. So I wear a hearing aid, and I got my hearing aid about 5 years ago. And I'm still having new experiences of things that I didn't really hear before or that I now hear differently. And they're interesting because, you know, you live your whole life a certain way, and then you shift something and it changes. So last night, my husband and I went and heard two Beethoven symphonies at the New York Philharmonic. And I did a thread about what it was like to be a deaf person hearing Beethoven for the first time with a hearing aid. And it was beautiful, and it completely changed the way that I heard some of the music, and it made me also hear that the composer was deaf in a way that I hadn't really understood before because of the way that I heard previous to having a hearing aid. Right? I was super excited and happy about this experience, and I shared it on Twitter, and then I had to add in, because I knew that a whole bunch of able-bodied people would swarm down on this and be all, "Ah, the deaf girl can hear Beethoven better. Here are my sad feels. Heart, heart, heart."
I love what you're saying. Anyway.
And I basically was like, "Hey, if you're an able-bodied person reading this, please do not have sad feels. This is my experience." And do not put this on other deaf people, because that is not their experience. This is my unique experience of hearing Beethoven with a hearing aid for the first time. Don't turn this into inspiration porn, because I am, this is not for you. Other disabled people can have their feelings about this, and we can all be warm and fuzzy and happy about it, but it's not for able-bodied people.
Yeah.
One of the things about, I think, inspiration porn that particularly pisses me off is not only is it a, oh, look at the sad disabled person that is getting helped by the able-bodied person, but it's also, oh, look at the sad disabled person. I don't want to be like them. So you get like the dichotomy of, you get the fear narrative in there too, where it's like, avoid that at all costs, which seems to happen. And like, I'm going to make this decision because clearly I don't want to be like that disabled person. It happens in, it's one of my favorite movies of all time, Starship Troopers. But you have the character who is disabled and, you know, the hero protagonist looks at him like he's, you know, a complete freak and oh god. Granted, they slightly confuse that later with Michael Ironside's character, who I believe also has, but he has been quote unquote fixed as well. So it's just one of those situations that I thought of when I was kind of thinking about the inspiration porn as not just a feels sort of like happy, yay, look at, aren't they lucky, but also a, oh god.
So I'm going to steer the bus into a slightly dark place for a minute.
Sure.
But one of the other things that you can never ever do is to have one of your able-bodied characters turn to a disabled character and say, I would just kill myself if I were like you.
Oh, yeah.
Why would you say that to somebody?
Well, people say it to me in real life all the time, and I have to tell you, it is one of the few things that causes me to really have to check violent impulses.
That's a horrible thing to say to somebody.
It really is.
Well, and in fantasy especially, there's a habit of characters killing off other characters, mercy killings, basically, because they feel bad for him, and that's not okay. That is, not on any level is that okay. And the message that's telling a lot of disabled people, like, your life isn't really worth it, so we might as well just put you out of your misery, is horribly demeaning.
It's why I really love Miles Vorkosigan. Because Miles Vorkosigan is, at some points, depressive, but we never have him ever essentially contemplating, I want to die because I'm disabled. And it's been a while since I read the books, but my memory of it is basically that's not ever his reason for throwing himself into potentially deadly situations.
Well, and the worst part is that a lot of the time the author, to me anyway, whether you disagree or not, please let me know. A lot of the time with that mercy narrative of the mercy killing, the disabled person says, please kill me.
Yep.
Yeah.
And you're like, wait, are they legitimately trying to somehow assuage their guilt by putting this on the disabled person?
Mm-hmm.
That's not okay in any way, shape, or form.
Oh no, they wanted me to kill them.
Right.
Immediately when you bring this up, it makes me think of House MD, the TV show.
Yep.
Because the character 13, for those who have not seen the show, she has, cannot remember the name of the condition. But it's a degenerative disease that's eventually going to make her lose control of her body and then she will die. And number of times throughout the show, through her sort of narrative arc, House actually offers to essentially be the person that will end her life when she desires it. Which, I don't know. I mean, coming from my perspective, it didn't seem like a problem. But I'm obviously coming from a different point of view, and that, I think that listening now and how we're talking about it now, I can see why that is deeply problematic in a way that I didn't see when I first watched it.
She also euthanizes her brother.
She does. That's right. You're correct. Yeah.
Who has Huntington's.
Right. Huntington's. Yeah.
You know, it is that show specifically. It doesn't have anything to do with science fiction or fantasy, but what it does do is it really normalized the idea of disabled people being mean and angry. Which I did appreciate, because, yeah, you know, not all disabled people are nice people. I am not a saint, I swear. I'm not very nice to people sometimes, and that's okay. I drank. Gasp.
Yeah. Well, I think it has a lot to do with the fact it's fine if a disabled person makes that decision for themselves. But when a writer takes it out of their hands and doesn't even necessarily center the disabled character in the conversation, but this, you know, ends up centering the heroic protagonist, in this case, House. Hard to call him heroic sometimes, but yeah.
He's not by the end. I think he's a piece of garbage by the end of that show. The last two seasons, the second to last season, you can't like anything about House. He's actually just a scumbag.
Well, it's hard to like him through most of it, but still, yeah. He is the protagonist of that show. And it he doesn't is. Necessarily yeah. center 13, it's centering his role in that conversation. And that's what happens so often in fiction, is that it's not about the disabled character. It actually ends up erasing the disabled character as part of the narrative in a lot of ways, as does the inspiration porn and pretty much everything else most of the time.
Well, I was going to say, and remembering, right, how we even find out she has Huntington's is because the House, the character, takes that out of her hands, right? He runs the tests and then basically manipulates her into looking at the results to see if she has the illness. I think it's interesting that everyone around her is trying to tell her how she's supposed to live her life, and nobody is just asking her what the hell she wants, at least for the most part. I think there's a couple moments when characters do ask her, but most part, it's like other people telling her how to live, right? You need to go do this treatment over here. You need to go do this thing. You need to behave this way. You need to take care of yourself in this way. And nobody is talking to her about what it is that she actually wants and supporting her decisions, which, I mean, House never does, but that it's the other characters also not doing it, I think makes that is really worrisome for a narrative for that show. And I can imagine that it probably pushes a lot of buttons for people. And now when I rewatch that show, which I will at some point, I'm sure now I will see all of the little signs that I hadn't noticed before because I wasn't thinking about it.
One thing about House that I did like, which was touched on already, but he, you know, he is an angry, horrible person. And he really did, that show really did help push the idea that disabled people don't need to be happy all the time. And we don't need to be thankful for the fact that, hey, at least I'm alive, or hey, at least it's not cancer, or any of that other crap that I hear all the time. The thing that people, I think in general, in humanity itself, needs to remember is just because I am disabled does not mean that I do not get pissed off about life or my situation. It doesn't mean that I'm going to be nice to you. It doesn't mean that I'm going to walk around, you know, throwing butterflies and unicorns at people. It just isn't going to happen. I am still a human being, and it is okay for me to feel a wide range of emotions. Just because I'm disabled does not negate any of that. And another thing I wanted to say was there seems to be an underlining belief in society itself that we disabled people would just be so much happier if we were able-bodied. Don't we all just yearn for that? And that's not the case. It goes along with feeling a wide range of emotions. It's okay for me to not like people, for example. And it is also okay for me to just live my life. And just because I have issues and my body's falling apart does not mean that I'm not living a full life. And that's it. My disability does not in any way mean that my life is worth less than anybody else's.
Well, and it's a spectrum. I mean, you can't just assume that every disabled person is going to be exactly this one way.
Yeah.
We all have different experiences interacting with our own disability, interacting with the larger world, you know, in terms of our disability. You can't just, you know, paint a nice, convenient picture of this is a disabled person and then expect disabled people to be like, yeah, that's totally my experience. And that's completely respectful. You need to have a wide variety of characters, which leads me to Was it Mike or Paul that asked this question? I feel like I have to give them credit for it. Of how do you avoid the Smurfette principle of this is the only disabled character in this book, and we're going to treat them like that represents all disabled people?
I think in some ways it's about having that disabled character, even if they don't do so within the context of the book, engage with the wider disabled community in some way. Whether it's a reference to other people that they know or somebody else talking about someone else, you can have them talk about a wider community or a wider experience. Because generally speaking, even if as a disabled person, you don't have any other disabled friends, which was the case for me until I grew up and met other disabled people, you still have sort of a knowledge of people you may have met once or twice. And disability isn't that uncommon. So if you're writing, I'm going to go with a fantasy world because I think that's interesting. If you have a character who's blind in a fantasy world and, you know, their village has, let's say they were blinded in some sort of horrifying dragon accident. We'll go with that. There's got to be at least 5 other people who were in that dragon accident. How did they experience it? What happened to them? So don't basically leave disability in an oubliette, I guess is what I'm trying to get at.
Yeah. I mean, 1/5 of Americans have a disability.
Yeah.
And I don't even think that actually accounts for things that should be considered a disability, but haven't been classified as such.
Well, I've also directed it the other way to look at that. 1/5 of Americans is disabled. But also, disability is the only minority that you can join temporarily and then go back to not being a part of it. Or right. Also, really, it's the easiest minority to join.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I've been there.
Unless if you convert to Judaism or Islam.
Well, so on the subject, we're talking about all of these examples of things that go wrong, right? Different kinds of issues, inspiration poor, the Smurfette principle, and so on. So we talked like a lot about the sort of negative side, and I would be curious of what you guys think are some of the more positive examples of when this is actually done right, or unless there are none. I'm assuming there has to be some.
Well, Sarah mentioned Stephanie Salter, so that's a good place to start.
So we got one. We got one for sure.
And I mentioned Miles Borkhausigan.
Right, so 2. So curious of any others that you can think of that you think do a particularly good job of representing people with disabilities.
I really liked Borderline by Michelle Baker.
Yes.
That's a good one.
That was fantastic. And to a lesser extent, I liked Lock-In for a few reasons by John Scalzi. And it was just because I could relate to the character in some ways. A lot of the discussion about disability in there really resonated with me, but let's see.
I would also say Updraft by Fran Wild.
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good one. Yeah.
Has a number of disabled characters in it, and Fran has written about how people didn't actually notice that there were disabled characters in it. Because I had been waiting to read it. It had been on my to-be-read queue for a while. And then I met Fran, and she says, so what did you think of Updraft? And, you know, I there were a bunch of disabled characters I'd seen you talking about disability. And I went, nobody told me that there were disabled characters in Updraft. What? Now I must put this at the top of my queue, because nobody noticed. Nobody thought to tell me.
So what... Oh, Sarah, I'll start with you. What about Borderline, specifically, did you think elevated it to a level of, you know, being respectful and positive and something to emulate?
It just felt really real to me. The main character had, didn't she have an amputation or something?
Yes,
as well
she did.
As well as the borderline personality issue. And she was just completely unapologetic about it. This is the way I am. This is how I live my life. And you guys can either deal with it or get out of my face. And I really, really liked that kind of unapologetic, true to herself, this is me type thing. It was well represented. It was very intimately crafted. It was just perfect. It was, I think, one of the best disability representation that I've read in a long time.
And Elsa, what about Updraft specifically?
I really liked, I can't remember the character's name right now, but there is a character who uses echolocation. And I really appreciated that Fran actually did some research on this, because there are people who are blind who use echolocation. This isn't actually a myth. There's a man named Daniel Kish, and he's done a lot of interviews on it, and he trains people who are blind in how to use echolocation. So I really appreciated that somebody had bothered to do that representation, but not do it in a way that was the superhero trope. Because there are real people who do this, and I liked getting to see it in a fantasy world where it wasn't some, you know, magic thing. Not that I don't like magic, I just appreciated seeing it not done that way.
Hmm. So, is the fellow you mentioned, is he the one that climbs trees?
Yes, he is.
I think he skateboards, too.
I listened to a whole show on him, I think it was on NPR.
Yes, it's the Invisibilia episode called The
yeah.
Batman. I actually was interviewed by NPR for that episode.
Were you really?
Yeah, I didn't end up in the final cut, but they talked to me about how to be sensitive to people with blindness who don't do it, because I'm deafblind, so I actually can't echolocate. So they called me up to ask about what sort of they could do to make sure that it was sensitive to all kinds of blindness.
Yeah, I'm no joke. When I listened to that episode, because I read the premise of what it was about, and I was like, okay, this has got to be, like, this is just a quack, right? This is a guy who's claiming he can do this, and he can't actually do it, and he's just trying to get people's money. Because it just sounds like a science fiction idea. And then they go into it, and I was like, this is amazing. This guy figured out how to do this amazing thing with, like he uses, like, marbles, right? And he just, like, clicks them in his mouth?
Yep.
And it's extraordinary. Like, just human beings can come up with the craziest things to figure out stuff. And I just was floored by just the effort to which he had gone. And on top of that, like, as he was trying to, like, start a school where he was teaching kids, and, like, the troubles he ran into because of the sort of the different cultural elements that go into the blind community and so on. It was very fascinating. I would try to find it and put a link in, because people should actually listen to that episode. It's absolutely fascinating.
And I will say, as a blind person, I actually do have some issues with him. I do think that he essentializes blindness in a lot of ways that really bothers me. So from my perspective, as somebody who is constantly saying that disability is not a binary and that not all disabilities are exactly alike, I think that when he says things like all blind people can do this, he's actually hurting a lot of people who can't. So yeah. I think that there's some problems with Daniel Kish, and I wanted to make that really clear when I brought him up. But I do think that he's an interesting character, and I call him a character because I feel like he kind of is. But he brings up something that's unique and interesting that I think writers can look at. I don't think you should overuse it, but I certainly think it's worth knowing about if you are writing blind characters.
Again, like you said, it's not a binary. I think there are nuances to how people interact with the world based on their disability. I was horribly teased in high school when I would say, oh, I'm blind in my left eye, so it's kind of hard if you are standing on my left side. I do have a marginal amount of peripheral, I wouldn't even call it vision, sensing, because it doesn't register as vision. It registers as pressure,
mm-hmm.
which nobody's ever going to be like, oh, you feel pressure when something's on your left side? Yes, I feel pressure. I don't see anything, right? It's a fascinating, which I never would have considered. I don't get the same sensation necessarily on my right side, in which I am visioned. But my right eye has completely taken over. Again, it's a nuance of my particular condition that a abled person might not even consider when writing about a blind character. But it's my reality. And I think that's what so often seems to get erased in all fiction, but particularly in science fiction and fantasy that have the ability to throw in those fixes, is that there is nuance to disability. we are all going to engage, like I said, with our own disabilities and with the world in a completely different way. And I personally haven't seen that really happen yet, but I haven't read these books that you guys suggested, so thank you for doing that. I'm looking forward to it. But also, in terms of the things that are not still, like mental health issues, which not everybody even considers a disability, but absolutely affects how people interact with the world, even those tend to be, I think, reductive in representation.
Yeah, my sister faces a lot of problems because she, when we were talking earlier about invisible disabilities, my sister is one of those. She has a service dog, and when she goes in public, she sometimes faces problems because what people assume with a service dog is, well, you're blind, and so you're either blind or you're training a dog for a blind person. And she has to kind of explain to them, well, no, it's for me, and then what sometimes people will do is they'll like start questioning her about her condition, which is enormously invasive, right? It's none of anyone else's business what your condition is. But she faces this problem a lot because she has obviously mental concerns. I don't want to get into specifics because she's my sister and I'm sure she would kill me. I guess the point I'm making is that for her, right, that there's this big problem that she wants to make visible and understood that she has a condition that affects her ability to live in certain ways, right? It affects in so many different ways how she behaves, and so that's why she has her dog. But the way the public perceives her is not that she has a disability. It's just like, oh, well, you just have this problem. You just need to get over it.
Get over it.
Yeah. Which I'm sure many people with all kinds of conditions and things get told, not just people with mental disabilities, right? We hear that often, this get over it, as though any condition can just be magically gotten over. You can just will it away and it'll go.
I think it's also worth mentioning when we're talking about service dogs and other service animals is like something that you can do in terms of writing fiction and even talking about disability is modeling appropriate behavior around service animals in your fiction. Because so often I see movies or TV shows kind of making fun of service animals. And I think modeling people not being assholes and touching people's service dogs would be really helpful.
Yes.
Punchline. A lot of the time. It's like, oh, and then I touched the service dog because it's just so cute and I can't help myself. It's like, no. Don't do that.
Well, and, you know, I notice this because, I mean, half the time, nobody can tell anything's wrong with me. Like, my lidocaine patches are usually hidden by clothes, and a lot of my braces and my KT tape and stuff like that, I can hide somehow. But on the days when I need to wear a brace and my brace is obvious, or I literally can't walk unless I have my cane, which is just about every other day now. I get asked all the time, what's wrong with you? First of all, what's wrong with you kind of bothers me. I don't like that question. I don't like people insinuating that my condition means that I have something. I mean, something is wrong with me, but it just feels very like comparison-ish to me. Like, I'm cool and you're just, look at how broken you are. I hate that. And then on the other hand, and just because someone has a mobility aid or they're wearing a brace or, you know, anything like that, that makes it obvious that something is going on where they need assistance, does not mean that you have the right to every detail of their personal life. If someone asks you, if someone says, well, what's wrong with you? Why do you need da, 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 da? And you don't want to answer, that's okay. Because you're obviously needing assistance doesn't mean your life is an open book all of a sudden. You do not lose your right to privacy. Not everybody wants to be open about their condition, and that's okay.
Well, yeah. It's a presumption that we're public property, right?
Yes.
I think one of the ways in which we can draw sort of comparisons for able-bodied people is if you've ever been pregnant, people suddenly decide that your body is public property.
Yeah.
And that happens to disabled people. I've actually had people yell at me for not letting them help me cross the street.
What?
A woman tried to hold my hand while I was crossing the street without asking me. I took my hand away, and her reaction was to yell at me for being ungrateful.
Oh my gosh.
What kind of asshole does that? That makes no sense. What happened to just asking? Do you need help? No? Okie dokie. Have a good day. Done.
There are, particularly in the U.S., but I imagine that it's because that's where I'm coming from. There is this presumption of, I think the ownership quotient comes in a lot with the fact that we have a social safety net, which is not in any way perfect for people with disabilities. And there is that struggle to get help, you know, but when an entire system is built around the presumption that you're lying, which I think happens
a lot
more often than not with disability, that's the reactions that you're going to get, you know, is that you're going to get those questions of, well, you can't possibly be disabled because I can't see it. A, or B, I can see it, but clearly you're faking it because that's used in comedy so often.
But it happens all the time, right? In so many films, there's that Johnny Knoxville movie where he pretends to be a mentally handicapped. Because it's haha funny that he gets to fake his way into the Special Olympics. And I don't know. It happens a lot, right? Where people fake having a disability, like to get a leg up on people or something. I don't exactly know what the, sorry, that's a bad phrasing, but yeah.
It's a great phrasing, and I think it's funny.
Okay.
Well, it's like Sarah said in the beginning about, like, somehow my disability is an advantage.
Yeah.
Like, and it's not that I can, I'm trying to sort of think about this, because there's the idea that all disabled people should, well, either they should get over it,
yeah,
or they should accept it, right? That somehow that's the binary too, from the outside looking in. But then for disabled people, we, like I said, there's a spectrum of acceptance versus rejection of whatever it is, whatever disability it is. Because I would fucking love, excuse my language, a bionic eye. That would be awesome. I've been dying for that development since I went blind in my left eye. But that's not to say that not that everybody is going to feel the same way about it, which is fine. But for people to somehow presume that I should have either accepted or rejected my disability, it's not their business. But when we frame it in the narrative so often as those are the only two options, or, you know, the idea that the some are faking it just to get that advantage, and but, you know, on the other hand, there's those people that it really is happening to, and we should pity them or whatever. That's what we get so far. And it's driven me crazy for years. So hence why we're having this podcast, I guess.
Yep.
So let's pull it back, because we're
yes,
we're like in the broad spectrum of this kind of conversation, and Jen and I are talking way too much.
Yes, I apologize.
Mostly it's just Jen. Jen just, that's just our relationship, basically, is I say a couple things and then Jen talks for 6 hours. I love you, Jen. I love you very much. But I want to bring us back to the science fiction community, the kind of, somewhat more generally, to get your perspectives on what you think are the challenges right now in getting the community to be, I'll use this phrasing, more empathetic to the concerns of the disabled members within our community. What are some of the biggest challenges that you see, and how do we possibly solve some of them? I mean, we won't get to go through all of them, but maybe some of the big ones that you think are really crucial. And I'll start with you, Elsa.
Well, I think we need more visibility. And I'm going to call out one specific thing that I think we can do, which is, there are a lot of science fiction conventions that aren't accessible to people with disabilities, and that have actively pushed back on the idea of being accessible. I'm not going to name names, but if you've been paying attention, you know who I'm talking about. And more or less, putting up a wheelchair ramp is not that big of a deal. Making sure that people with wheelchairs can get onto, say, a stage to give a talk is not that big of a deal. But also,
making sure that people with disabilities are included on panels that aren't about disability, but are about just general writing is important, because we are here, we are writing, we are editors, and if you're not including us in your anthologies or in your conventions or on any kind of visible media, then you're not actually representing all of science fiction. And so I see this as a problem.
To add on to that, last year I actually had an experience that has made it so I don't even try to attend conventions anymore. Someone asked me if I wanted to be on some panels at their convention, and I said yes, and they sent me this form to fill out about, you know, stuff. And so I was filling it out, and they had checked this box or something, if you will be available between these dates, because that's when the convention was. And I checked the box, but I put a note underneath that said I have a condition that means that I don't know. From day to day, I might not be able to be there physically. So just to be on the safe side, I would recommend you guys have a backup for my spot in case I can't be there at this time due to my physical condition. And they wrote me back a letter that basically said, well, if you can't guarantee you'll be there, then we're not interested in having you. And they just wrote me off. They said, they basically kissed my ass, see you later. And since then, I haven't even tried. I haven't tried to go to conventions. I haven't tried to be on panels. I would love to be on panels. I think it would be fantastic. But because I was just written off like that, I don't even want to try. It felt horrible.
Well, and it's such an easy thing for them to do, right? I mean, and most of these, I can't think of an accessibility issue or a way to include people that is actually difficult. It just requires an ounce of effort, just 1 ounce, not an entire pound of effort, 1 ounce of effort. And yet so many people are unwilling to go through that.
And I can think of one thing that I understand is expensive, and that's ASL interpretation, because ASL is a very specialized skill, and you need to actually know how to speak the language. That being said, you can build that in. That's an expense you should be able to account for. So while I understand that it's expensive, I'm also not willing to just say, and so it's okay, you don't have to include it. Like, you do. And making things more accessible will mean that there are more people willing to pay you money to come to your con.
Right? 1/5 of Americans! Just saying. If a fifth of us would like to be fairly treated, maybe, just maybe, you might want to consider doing something. It's a pretty big number.
Well, and it's a weird thing, too, because I swear, like, every single year we have to have the same conversation about, like, what I think, Elsa, you said earlier, right, that the simple thing of just having a wheelchair ramp, right, almost every single year. And I'm pretty sure most of these conventions are housed at hotels. Like, aren't they required to have accessibility materials in the hotel anyway?
They are. It's sort of complicated. And I've made this offer before, but, like, I do accessibility for conventions, mostly for gaming cons, but I'm willing to do it for science fiction cons. If people want to hire me, I'm available. I have made myself available to people if they need me.
Right. I think that also goes to the idea of sensitivity readers. Like, they exist. You might want to consider interacting with them because it's kind of important.
Just a little bit. Just a little important.
Just a little bit. I like that.
One of the things that frustrates me, and maybe it shouldn't frustrate me, maybe I'm a horrible person for feeling like this, but, you know, I have this website, Our Words, which I've been trying to kick off the ground. I've basically given up on completely. And the reason why...
No!
Well, the reason why is because, first of all, I can't get anyone who wants to talk about this stuff on my website, so I give up on it. But the second thing is there seem to be trends in the science fiction and fantasy community where during con season, people will be upset for a few days because of accessibility issues, right? And that'll be like this big thing for maybe a week or two. But then all of a sudden, it doesn't matter anymore. And we've all moved back onto feminism or something else. Now, that's fine because people need to be irate about feminism. They need to be irate about these issues. But what bothers me is how easy it is for the science fiction and fantasy community to largely just forget that disabled people have issues that need the kind of attention that the feminist community gets. I don't understand why we can only be irate about one thing at a time. And can't we spread that around? If you're mad about something else, please pay attention to the disabled people because we're getting overlooked over here. Nobody's mad enough about us.
Also, just to throw this out there, there's this theory. I don't know if you've heard about it. Kimberly Crenshaw came up with it in the 1980s. It's a super great theory. It's called intersectional feminism.
Right? Newsflash!
This exists. You can be a feminist and care about other things. Women of color. People with disabilities. Also, let's go back to this notion of being disabled can be this identity that goes over a number of things. You can be Jewish and disabled. You can be Black and disabled. You can be Latina and disabled. You can be any number of things and disabled. So don't tell me that you don't care about disability because you're worried about something else.
To be fair, though, it has... more people have been paying more attention to it. I've noticed that more conventions are willing to have panels on disability and stuff like that. I've noticed that more big name authors are talking about it. It's not enough. And it frustrates me that it is so easy for the community to just push us in the background. And except for a few voices from a few very big name authors who've been kind enough to give us their attention and help us push our agenda, we're just largely ignored until somebody doesn't get a ramp onto a stage or something. And it shouldn't be like that. The ramp shouldn't be an issue in the first place. Accessibility shouldn't be a problem. And I genuinely feel if people got as irate and paid as much attention to these issues as they did to so many other issues that we lose our heads over, we would be a lot further along in this than we currently are. But we just, it get pushed to the sides and forgotten way too much, and it just pisses me off. So there we go.
Seriously, I just went and followed our words on Twitter. Why are there only 34 followers?
Because nobody cares.
No, 110 followers, but like, seriously, I would write for you. I didn't even know you existed.
Yeah, I've been trying, and then I wrote a few posts a few months ago, and I've been emailing authors, and I've been really hitting the pavement, and nobody responds, or nobody wants to, or they're uncomfortable to talk about this stuff. And I've literally just kind of thrown my hands up in the air and said, well, nobody gives a shit about the disabled, so my website is just going to fade away. That has literally been my experience with it so far.
No! Well, this is part of the reason that I've been trying to get you on in some capacity for since you launched the site. And I was so excited that it existed as a, you know, one-stop shop. And I'm still excited that it exists now. I hope you'll go back to it because...
Well, I'm actually working with Fantasy Faction on some stuff. They want me to write on disabilities on their website. And that, I think, will help get some attention to my website. But other than that, I just don't know. I mean, I can stand on Twitter because nobody wants me at their conventions because I'm not cool enough. I can sit there on Twitter and I can scream about this stuff at the top of my lungs, but it's not feminism or something like that. So nobody cares. That's how I feel. And it just endlessly frustrates me. I don't know what else to do.
I know how you feel. I definitely have had that feeling of, like, I talk about things and people get excited about what I have to say. And I'm pretty, you know, upfront about what my issues are. But you're right, eventually people forget what you stand for. And, all I know is this is why I keep shouting at people and why I keep doing things like this.
There's a reason my default state is upset. You see erasure in, and like you said, Elsa, there is this thing called intersectional feminism, and I think, we have to keep shouting on all the different issues. It really is, it seems so often that disability particularly is just completely erased from the narrative, even though it is probably the most intersectional thing that you can possibly imagine, since it does affect every single other marginalized community. It's not that these things don't interact with each other on a daily basis, and it should be the default state. Inclusion should be the default state of everything, from conventions to the short story.
Hear, hear.
I've seen a lot of people putting together anthologies recently for one thing or another, and a lot of them are based on diversity or something like that, and they'll call women, women of color, people in the LGBT community, immigrants, and the list goes on, and I'll look at the list and there won't be disabled in it, nowhere in it. And that just makes me furious. It just, that really gets my blood boiling real fast. We're just completely overlooked. And yes, it's getting better, largely because people are starting to yell louder, and authors with names that people follow are starting to say things. But other than that, it's just been like trudging through molasses uphill. It's been very hard. I don't know.
Education is exhausting, right?
Yeah.
I hear you. And being disabled, our lives tend to be a lot about having to educate people, because, like we've been saying, every disability is different. So while we often end up being the people who have to teach people about our specific brand of disability, even if we aren't experts on everybody else with our disability, we have to teach people how to deal with us. I actually recently was walking down the street with a fellow science fiction writer, and I had to teach her how to walk on the street with me, because there's an onboarding experience of, yes, I need you to walk on my blind side because I can hear you on that side. I don't want you on my seeing side because I can't hear you over there. The book I'm currently querying is about a blind woman who is basically in the middle of a supernatural apocalypse, and she has to basically lead a bunch of sighted people out of New York City. But there are multiple blind people in this book, and I was talking to someone about it, and they were like, well, how do you tell the difference between the blind people? I'm like, well, they're different kinds of blind, you know. One of them uses a guide dog, the other one doesn't, you know. Also, one of them is a Muslim American and the other one isn't. I don't know what to tell you. They're different kinds of people, but they're both blind. Then, of course, my favorite is then someone says, so how are they different from you?
Yeah. Okay. So we're getting close to, I think, about an hour here. And I think we're going to have to can of worms a bit, because there's a lot more we could definitely talk about. And I think we may have to return to this.
It's an ongoing conversation, right?
It's a massive conversation. It involves a lot of different facets. I mean, I think a lot of the stuff that we wanted to talk about, we've kind of scratched the surface.
Barely in some ways.
Barely in some ways. Yeah, certainly the case. So I do want to take a moment to have each of you say a little bit about, your work, where to find you, if you got something coming out you'd like to let people know about, that sort of thing. And I'll just go from my perspective, left to right. So we'll start with you, Sarah. So want to let folks know where to find you and anything cool you want to let people know you're working on?
You can find me on my website, bookwormblues.net, and eventually I might start working on Our Words again, but I don't know. And you can find me on Twitter as at bookwormblues, and I'm on Facebook. I'm everywhere.
Excellent. And what about you, Elsa?
I can be found on Twitter at SnarkBat, and I currently have two things I want you to be aware of. One of them is that Fireside Fiction is opening for submissions in March,
And we would love to have disabled writers submit their stories. We really want more from people who are disabled. And if you're from another marginalized community, obviously we're happy to have you too. And my second thing is, on March 7th, I'm in Uncanny Magazine writing about disability and the resistance, and I hope that you read it, and I hope that you see us when we're talking about activism, because we are out there. So those are two places you can find me soon. And, you know, keep your fingers crossed that I can keep up with all of the submissions in March. Being a low-vision assistant editor is a challenge.
Awesome. Well, thank you both. Thank you, Sarah and Elsa, very much for coming on and talking with us and, you know, opening up and, you know, telling us a lot about yourselves and your experiences. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And Jen?
What?
Jen?
Am I here?
You're here. I want the end of this to be like it always is.
Which is what?
You know, awkward ending. And scene.
Oh, do I get to say that?
No, it's done. I've already done it. It's awkward, Jen. It's over.
Okay. Thanks, Sean, <You're welcome. laughs> for making that even more awkward than usual.
You're welcome. All right, guys. We're actually done. Thank you for listening to the show. If you'd like to get in touch with us, you can find us at skiffyandfanty@gmail.com, on Twitter at skiffyandfanty, on Facebook at The Skiffy and Fanty Show, and on Patreon at patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. Our intro and outro music comes from The Launch by Cronux. You can find out more about their music at freemusicarchive.org.